It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today we're talking about polar bears. They're a unique symbol of the Arctic and one of the most beautiful and awe-inspiring animals you can see in Alaska. Visiting a polar bear in the zoo doesn't prepare you for the grandeur of these incredible animals as they thrive on the ice ecosystem. Polar bears are classified as marine mammals, and they are amazing swimmers, but they also seem to be strangely like us with their curiosity, their appearance, and their mastery of the world in which they live. Their success in that harsh world is a testament to the power of nature. In the first half of the show, we'll learn about that biological and ecological story with a world-renowned biologist, polar bear scientist. In the second half, coming up in half an hour, I'll talk with Michael Engelhard, who has published a terrific new book on the meaning of polar bears in our culture. Well, my first guest today is joining us from Canada. Andrew DeRocher is a professor of biology at the University of Alberta. He's been studying polar bears for 30 years, and in my writings about the Arctic, I've talked to him repeatedly over the years because he has been involved in some of the seminal research on the conservation of bears as the climate is changing. And I wanted to begin today just to talk about what an amazing animal this is. I remember my first experience in seeing a polar bear. It was just something extraordinary. It's not only that you're seeing an animal as if you saw it in the zoo that you think, well, it's a man-eater, it's huge, it's important, but it's extraordinarily beautiful animal, and it's very much unlike anything you've ever seen, being a marine mammal out in the ocean that is also a bear and seems like a land animal and so graceful and so powerful. I'm sure you must have some of that same sense of appreciation of the bear in your studies, Andrew.
Exactly. I mean, you can't go up into the Arctic and head out onto the sea ice and see bears in that environment and just be fascinated by an animal that can make a living in that sort of place. I mean, I can remember the first time I was out on the sea ice. It was up in the Beaufort Sea on the Canadian side of the southern Beaufort Sea population. And way out there, it was cold. I was a kid from, west coast of Canada and wasn't used to the cold like that. And here are these animals making a living and obviously thriving in that environment. There's no landscape features to navigate by, and yet these bears, some of the bears we were catching that year back in the 80s were, animals that had been tagged 10 years before, and they were caught in just the same sort of area. So these animals have this amazing ability to find a way to make a living out there, and incredibly beautiful as well. So you've got this sort of perfect combination of beauty and the beast. And, you see one blood-soaked with the blood of a seal, and you think, holy cow, this is a real killer. But then when they're all cleaned up or a little tiny cub, and they're just amazingly beautiful to watch as well.
Yeah, the adaptation. I mean, if there's an animal that shows sort of the concepts of how evolution adapts wildlife for its environment, the polar bear has got to be one of the very best examples, because so many aspects of its biology are perfectly adapted to that sea ice environment, which is so difficult. And one aspect that I was surprised by when first encountering polar bears when I was working as a journalist is how invisible they are. I mean, unless you are really watching for them, you can miss them.
We're not sure exactly how long that they've been white and trying to hunt seals, but it's certainly in the order of several hundred thousand years to perhaps several millions. It's a little hard to tell from the genetic data, and we don't have good fossil record, but these animals make a living by being sneaky. They use the terrain, which in this context is rough sea ice or leads and broken pieces of open water that they can get into to get out and hunt seals. So, the seals don't want to be eaten, so it's really sort of like an arms race to see, the seals try to get away and figure out mechanisms to do that, but the bears also find ways to catch the seals. And, you look at where they came from, of course, it's a grizzly bear ancestry, and one of the big adaptations of the bears, of course, is they went white, and that's just an obvious sort of camouflage approach for sneaking up on seals. But, they're pretty crafty. They certainly use wind, so they make sure they're not giving up to the seals where they are. And, of course, sometimes hunting seals at breathing holes, and they're just incredibly patient. You can see bears lie there for hours on end, knowing that with any luck, a seal will come up for a breath there, and they'll be ready and willing to take it out of the water and eat it.
So, yeah, seals are fast, so they can't exactly, I mean, although bears are good swimmers, they're not going to be able to catch one swimming underwater, so they have to use stealth and sort of snap them as they get up on the ice and when the seal is less able to move, right?
It's exactly it. One of the peak feeding times for polar bears is coming up in the springtime when ring seals, which are one of their major prey species, are giving birth to their pups. And those pups are actually born above the surface of the ice, but usually in a small den or lair that the mother has hollowed out in a snowdrift. And polar bears have an incredible sense of smell, and they can actually track these out underneath the snow. And this is where you see some of these sort of classic moments in wildlife films, you know, where the bear rears up on its hind legs and pounds through the surface of the lair to try to close off the exit for where that seal pup would get away, or if they're really lucky, the mom will be there as well, nursing the pup, and then they just dig them out, find them, and haul them out. So a lot of the energy that a polar bear takes in is actually occurring in a very small window in the springtime when the pups are most vulnerable.
So then they just build on a fat layer and make it through the rest of the year? Is that sort of like our brown bears make it through the winter?
It's exactly it. It's interesting. You know, they came from this grizzly bear, brown bear ancestor, and yet they live almost totally opposite lifestyles. You know, if you go around anywhere in the Arctic now, you can't find grizzly bears. They're all hibernating over winter in dens, whereas polar bears are just, this is the period when they make a living. During the summer period, they're basically living off those fat stores. And, you know, the simplest way to think about a polar bear is the whole thing that makes them tick is that they have access to the blubber of seals. And this is an incredibly rich energy source. And that allows them to take in this huge amount of energy in a very small period of time with great efficiency. And the way I sort of think about them is, think about a polar bear as a fat vacuum. They just go around, catch a seal, scrape the fat off of them. They don't eat much of the meat. There's not as much energy there. And then somewhere around 90-95% of that fat goes unmodified pretty much right into their own fat cells. So it's a great mechanism for storing up this huge amount of energy, because once the ice starts to break up, seals aren't stupid. They don't, you know, they can get away by not being near ice floes where polar bears can get them. So it's a great system. You get super fat, and then you can work off that fat store for extended periods. We have pregnant female polar bears in parts of the Arctic that can go 8 months without eating anything, but they are also burning up about 2 pounds of body fat per day that they're not feeding. So this is a pretty neat mechanism and perfectly adapted for this Arctic environment.
That's just amazing. It's also just interesting in that the ocean is so much richer than the land in terms of the quantity of calories that are available for wildlife. And I guess part of that is just because these seals are hunting over a wide area and are gathering up the fat and then the sort of delivering that fat to the bears so that the bears can eat it and do the storage process that you're talking about.
It's pretty much a given. It doesn't matter if you're in a terrestrial environment or a marine environment in the Arctic. Because of this huge productivity pulse that comes through the summer and the lack of productivity during the winter, almost all Arctic species rely on fat to get them through the winter. The other option is, if you can't store up a whole bunch of fat, then you have to leave the Arctic. So you look at some of the migratory species that come up for just the summer and then leave. And so you think about all the birds and some of the whales that come and then leave. But if you're staying there, you have to have an energy source. And that starts right down at the very sort of base of the food chain, right with the small, what we call zooplankton, sort of the shrimp-like animals, right down at the base. They also have lots of reliance on fat. And of course, that gets into the fish, and the fish get into the seals. So this fat basically moves up through the food web and ends up in huge quantities in polar bears. You know, a really fat polar bear can have half of its body weight as being fat. So, you know, as we're apt to say, fat is where it's at for a polar bear, and no polar bear ever looked at its reflection in a pond and thought, I'm too fat.
No.
They're just driven, really, to accumulate body fat. And so it's, You know, in evolution, we talk about survival of the fittest. Well, for polar bears, it's survival of the fattest.
Right, which I guess is part of why they're able to stay warm, because they're burning all those calories. So when you are studying and you're developing this story of the polar bear and how it survives and how it's changing through time, you've got to go out and catch them, right? And I just think of that as like, that's a sort of the... That is the maximum adventure for a wildlife biologist, is catching polar bears. How do you do that?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. I mean, it's over the years we've adapted to the environment and found techniques that work really well. The drugs that we use on polar bears are incredibly safe. As I'm apt to tell people, you're actually, you know, polar bears are safer being drugged by a polar bear scientist than you actually are going into the hospital and being drugged by a doctor. Part of the reason is like, we're actually catching like the equivalent of Olympic athletes. These animals are incredibly good body condition, good shape. The drugs we use are very robust, and the bears handle it very well. Over the years, I've caught lots of polar bears. It's interesting, as technologies have advanced, we actually are less reliant on catching bears and have developed less invasive techniques. But it's pretty simple process to catch a polar bear. You head out on the ice, you know the type of habitats they're going to be in. We're not really looking for bears. That's a pretty much a loser's game for the most part. They're just so low density. So what we're looking for is tracks, and then at the end of the tracks is the track maker. You can quickly assess how big they are, open up the back door of the helicopter and lean out, shoot a dart into them. They're usually asleep somewhere between 4 and 8 minutes, and they're pretty safe to work on. The drugs we use kind of make them pretty relaxed, so they're not really even that dangerous. So it always sounds scary, but it's actually, I'm never worried about the bear that we're actually drugging. What I'm always worried about is the sort of an adage that we say is, if there's one bear, there's two bears. If there's two bears, there's probably three. There's a reason why they're in that area. And quite often it can be really hard to see the other bears that you're not trying to catch. And of course, bears are incredibly curious. Doesn't matter what species of bear. You land a helicopter, and all of a sudden you might actually have a visitor coming in to check out what's going on.
Well, and as I mentioned, they can creep up on you without you noticing, something that I experienced when I was working on my book about the Arctic. It's sort of like the bear got pretty close before I even, and I didn't see it. A hunter who was with me and knew how to scan saw it. And that sort of raises the question of, like, when do bears eat people? I there certainly have been cases when it's happened. And I suppose maybe it's a question of when they're extremely hungry. I mean, there's certainly no reason they can't eat people, right? I mean, they're so large and so fierce that that it would be pretty easy for them to take down a human being.
You know, if they really wanted to, they could do a much better job of it. They're pretty timid animals. They're very cautious. I would say the biggest problems we have with problem polar bears, and the ones that actually get into trouble, are bears that are either really young and inexperienced, and quite often food stress, like they don't have enough to eat. The other end of the spectrum is the really old bears. Those are the ones that are kind of running out of options. Their teeth are probably damaged. They don't have the fat stores. They're desperate. They'll do anything. And so those are the ends of the spectrum. Most bears in good condition, they just don't care. A fat bear is not usually a risk to humans. The biggest problem we've got right now in the Arctic is that bears are spending more time on land as the sea ice changes, and that quite often puts them around communities. And if there's lots to eat, as there are, you know, when you've got bowhead whale carcasses on the North Slope in Alaska, those bears are fat and happy, and they don't really cause much trouble. The perils are in other places in the north where the bears are really skinny, and then they're looking for things to eat. And quite often, as we know in the north, people have dog food or carcasses around their properties, and the bears come in. They're not shy about looking for free meals.
Right, and that's when you need to know how to use a rifle, I guess. I mean, what... other than just avoidance, what do you advise people to protect themselves in those situations?
Well, you know, there's lots of different things, and it depends on the situation you're in. You know, in some of the places, I mean, I wouldn't go without a gun. There's no question that that's a good backup. But I mean, if you get down to it, a lot of people aren't very experienced with using firearms, and you're actually probably a bigger danger to other people in your party than you are to the bear. So, you know, that is one issue. In some circumstances, bear spray works really well. There's good evidence that it works just as well on polar bears. You know, there's lots of mechanisms for staying safe. You know, if you've got a camp, we always have a tripwire alarm system, so at least we know if a bear's coming around. So there's lots of things you can do to sort of reduce the risk. But, you know, all in all, polar bears aren't that interested in mucking around with people. They're curious, but they don't come in with sort of that, for the most part, a predatory instinct to kill us and eat us. If they did, we'd have a lot more dead people. But if you look at it, black bears and grizzly bears are a lot more dangerous. But, of course, there's a lot more people living in black bear and grizzly bear habitats. So,
right.
I don't trust them. That's the bottom line. But if you give me a choice, if I'm up in the north and it's a barren ground grizzly bear or a polar bear, I'll take a polar bear any day.
All right. Good advice. Is my guest today on Outdoor Explorers, Andrew DeRocher. He's a professor of biology at University of Alberta and has been studying polar bears for decades and has done some very important work on polar bear conservation and the status of this important animal, which is a symbol in so many ways. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our show today is focusing on the polar bear, the science and the culture of this animal. And a new book that has come out from the University of Washington Press, which talks about those cultural aspects, and we'll have that author on in the second half of the show. So polar bears became a new symbol because of their vulnerability to climate change, and I know you were important in the work that established that connection of the climate change threat to polar bear conservation, Andrew. And I'm interested in what the factors are in the warming climate which are the most threat to polar bears. You mentioned that the seals have their pups in snow dens. I suppose if the snow isn't there, that's a problem. Also, the lack of sea ice means that the polar bears don't have their terrain that they live on. What do you feel are the main factors impacting the polar bear?
Well, it's interesting because polar bears clearly have become this sort of icon for climate change around the world. And it's interesting, it wasn't like polar bear scientists set out to do that. That was never the objective. One of the reasons that we know so much about polar bears and they became this icon is because we were studying them intensely. There's an international agreement signed by the five Arctic nations with polar bears from back in 1973 where countries are obliged under this agreement to study polar bears. So most of the research that went on was dedicated to finding out how many bears were in different areas and how many could we sustainably harvest from these different populations. So we had all this background of information, and in these monitoring studies to estimate population size, we had lots of other data on reproductive rates and body condition and survival. And one of the things that became very clear is that we knew that polar bears were dependent on sea ice to make a living, but we could see that as the sea ice was changing, that reproduction, body condition, survival rates were changing in concert. And the simplest way to look at polar bears and the climate change story is it's really absolutely no different than any other species that's at risk across the world. And almost always, if it comes down to one thing, it's habitat loss. So it doesn't matter if we're looking in Africa or South America or in the Arctic. You take away an animal's habitat, and you usually see the populations decline. And it gets more challenging for species like polar bears that are so highly specialized that have this ecological place that they're exploiting. And if it's disappearing, there's very little chance that it's going to turn back hundreds of thousands or millions of years of evolution. And while it's nice to think that they might become more terrestrial, we talk about the ecological space that an animal occupies. Well, the terrestrial bear ecological space is already occupied. That's occupied by barren ground grizzly bears. They're doing just fine, and they'll actually thrive in a slightly warmer climate. But polar bears, unfortunately, probably won't. We don't have enough time for them to adapt. And there's only so far we can push an animal like that before we start to see population declines, which is what we are seeing now off the north coast of Alaska and the southern Beaufort Sea. And some of the other populations are also in decline now. Others are doing just fine, though. So it depends on where you are.
Well, you've seen a trend line in the health and status of the body, health of the polar bear that matches the trend line of warming. But something that listeners may be wondering about is, well, there have been periods of warmth in the past, right? And presumably the polar bears made it through those. Or is this animal so new that it's never really seen temperatures as warm as what we are experiencing or expecting?
Well, it's always comes up as an issue. One of the problems is certainly the bears have seen warm periods, and certainly their distribution and the sea ice was different at times. One of the challenges is if you actually talk to sea ice scientists, is they don't have a really good estimate of what the deep time sort of sea ice conditions were like. But it's pretty clear from some of the more recent work that has been done by sea ice scientists and sort of these paleoclimate people is that there has almost always been sea ice for as long as there have been polar bears. Yes, there have been periods where it's been much warmer. There's also have been periods where it has been much colder. And in those cold periods, we know that polar bears were pushed much further south. So we have fossil remnants of polar bears down around Sweden, Denmark, and that part of the world. So they came south when we had a glaciation. It was much colder in the Arctic. The challenge going forward is that when you talk to the sea ice scientists and the climatologists, they're saying that we're going to have this directional loss and sea ice won't be coming back anytime in the near future. And the challenge becomes is that there just won't be enough sea ice. And our best estimates are that we're going to lose many of the populations by mid-century. And then once we get out towards the end of this century, the best estimates are we're still going to have polar bears, but they'll be restricted to the very high Arctic. So the northern parts of Greenland, the northern parts of Canada. And at that time, now we've got a very small population of a species. And it's not just climate change that is a threat to polar bears. We're going to have issues of new diseases coming as species move north. We've already got very high pollution levels in polar bears as well. So if we start to get to small populations, then the challenges become much more difficult for conservation biologists, but that's going to be for future generations to deal with. But it's pretty clear that polar bears are going to be pressed by habitat loss, and we'll have a lot fewer of them going forward in time.
excuse me. I think a lot of the science about marine animals shows that species are moving north rapidly, much faster than terrestrial animals are moving north. As the climate is changing, and we're seeing the ranges of various fish multiple degrees farther north, and it's always struck me that for some animals that may be manageable, right? They could just have a habitat that's farther north. For polar bears, as you said, they're very finely adapted to a niche, which is sea ice, and not only the sea ice, but also to have sea ice and land, right? Maybe they could just live around the North Pole, but they have to be able to get off the ice at points when it melts. So their habitat, if the sort of the warmth gradients move farther north and move past where they normally live, it kind of disappears completely from the planet. They can't just move farther north because there's no farther north for them to go. Is that true?
That's pretty much it. One of the big challenges, and you know, one of the interesting issues is we think about polar bears up in the Arctic, way out on the sea ice. But if you actually get down to it, they're a species of the continental shelves. So they really want to be near shore where the water is relatively shallow, partly because, as most of us know, marine productivity is higher. And because the productivity is higher, there's more fish, there's more seals. And so if you look at sort of the situation around Alaska, it's really kind of interesting because if you look in the Beaufort Sea, that's a really tiny continental shelf. And then you go further offshore and you're into water that's several thousand feet deep. It's very unproductive. One of the two species of seals that polar bears eat, bearded seals, they only dive down to a few hundred feet. They feed on the ocean bottom. And so you can't have that seal living in those environments. They just don't can't make a living out there. Those waters tend to be much less productive ecologically, and so polar bears can't make a living there. So if you look at the situation in Alaska, as the ice has moved farther and farther offshore in the summer, some of the bears have opted to jump onto land for the summer. Some of them are still trying to stay far out on that sea ice. But it also means that you're asking the bears to make a lot of changes in their lifestyle. And one of them is that, well, if I had to walk 500 miles extra north every year and then 500 miles further south to come back into my hunting areas, I would lose weight, and polar bears are doing exactly the same thing. One of the curious things is if you look at the Alaska situation, if you just go a little bit further west into the Chukchi Sea, that's an area population that's shared with Russia. Those bears aren't showing nearly the sorts of effects that the Beaufort Sea bears are, because in that part of the world, the continental shelf is huge, and it goes much, much farther north. So right now, the bears in that area are doing quite well, but right next door, because of the ecological conditions, the bears aren't doing as well. So like you said, you can't just push this species further north. There's no more places for it to go. Curiously, you know, in the Canadian Arctic, we are seeing some species come further north. Grizzly bears, for example, are expanding up into the Canadian Arctic islands and doing quite well up there as the climate is warming. So there will be winners and losers. Polar bears will be one of the losers. In parts of the Canadian Arctic, we can see one of the potential new winners is actually going to be killer whales. They're increasing in abundance in the Arctic dramatically. So, again, winners and losers in this game, and yeah, it's quite clear where polar bears end up on that.
Well, and a lot to study there for you. And I guess in the minute or so we have left, I'm curious as to what you see as the frontier for your studies and for your students' studies. You've pretty well established the threat of climate change to polar bears, and that trend line, sadly, is probably just going to continue. What new things do you want to find out about polar bears?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things here is, you know, people say, what should you study? And I say, well, look, we actually understand the problem. So now what we're really doing is monitoring the situation so we can continue to document the sorts of changes that are occurring. We're spending a lot of time trying to expand into the areas where we think that polar bears will remain in the longest term. Try to get some background data. So one of our high priorities in the Canadian context is to try to look at what's going on in the very high Arctic. Right now, we have very few bears living in those areas, partly because the sea ice is really, really thick. So we've got a multi-year ice in some of those areas, but it is changing. And we have done some studies, and we had predicted that as the sea ice thinned, switch from what we call multi-year ice that lasts for many years to annual ice, that we would see an increase in productivity. We haven't seen that yet, so we're still trying to scratch our heads as to what's going on, and it may deal with whole ecosystem productivity issues. But we are continuing to track individual bears, trying to look at what is happening, and part of it is, as a scientist, we're interested in how the bears make a living. Sometimes it's just curiosity driven. A lot of our work, though, does pertain to reinforcing our understanding of the energy balance of these bears, so the energy in versus the energy out. And it's surprising at just how complicated that can be, but it is a concern going forward. We understand the problem, though, so it's not really refining that very much anymore. It's more a monitoring of the status of the species going forward.
Fascinating. I'm envious hearing you talk about it, of how interesting your work is, and being out in that beautiful, beautiful country studying these magnificent animals. A great career, and thank you for your great contributions to science. We've been talking with Andrew DeRocher, who's a professor of biology at the University of Alberta. Thanks for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure chatting with you.
Well, please stay with us on Outdoor Explorer. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about a new book which discusses the culture and the impact of the polar bear on society.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. And with me now is Michael Engelhard, who is an author in Fairbanks and who has a new book from the University of Washington Press called Ice Bear, The Cultural History of an Arctic Icon. So in the first half of the show, we talked about biology. Now we're going to talk about what this animal means in our culture and the many, many images we have of polar bear, which range from terrifying killer to sort of cuddly, infantilized creature, which in my guest book, all of those images are recreated in excellent illustrations. Just very clear. The whole book is on shiny paper, and the reproduction quality is very good, and the text is extremely in-depth about the different cultural aspects of the meaning of the polar bear. So I'm really, really delighted to have you with me today, Michael Engelhard. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And he's on the phone again because he's in Fairbanks. So tell me how this project began, because obviously you've got this huge collection of materials, and I'm curious as to where all this came from.
Well, there are actually several origin stories, so to speak. One of them is my longstanding interest in symbolic dimensions of landscapes, and for me, the wildlife of a particular landscape is one of the strongest components of the landscape, and freight it with a lot of symbolic meanings. And for the polar bears in particular, I've had a special affinity with bears through my work as a guide. Among other things, I encountered my first polar bear in the wild on the Canning River a few years ago on a trip that I was guiding, and it turned out to be the farthest inland sighting at that point in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that had been reported. And it just did something to me where I wanted to learn more about the creature, and I started reading up on it, and then I realized that a lot has been written about polar bear encounters and by biologists and scientists, but there is really no one book available, or has been, that dealt with entirely the history, the cultural history, and the symbolic aspects of the animal. And so I decided to set out and write my own.
Until looking at your book, it didn't occur to me how rich this area is of the cultural images of the polar bear and the cultural meaning of the polar bear. It's really an animal that, although not very many people have seen it, seems to reach into every corner of our shared sort of life together in terms of just using this animal as an image.
I think if you especially look at the depth of time, about 8,000 years at least of documented shared history between polar bears and humans, you'd be hard-pressed to find any other animal on Earth that is probably so freighted with meanings as the polar bear. I dare you. Even wolves and whales are not coming close to that.
Yes.
And part of it has to do with the resemblance between bears and humans. That's one big aspect that is important for why it captures the human imagination to the degree that it has.
Expand on that, if you would.
Well, I mean, in the Northern Hemisphere, the polar bear is probably the closest thing to an animal that resembles humans that we have. There are no great apes, in more tropical latitudes. That would be the gorilla and the chimpanzee. But here, it's an old head that, the skin body of a polar bear or any kind of bear looks like a naked human being. But then down to details, even behavioral details, down to its curiosity, the maternal care that the female polar bear exerts on its young, the upright position that it occasionally assumes, the stereoscopic vision, eyes located in the front of the head, largely meat-eater, sleeps or hibernates in dens that very much resemble igloos, the Canadian Central Arctic Inuit's igloos, seal hunter. So all this made it very close to people, and still does to even non-northerners. There's still that human resemblance.
Yeah.
A female polar bear that nurses, you could... And the position is almost literally identical with that of a nursing woman.
Interesting. They do have that aspect where when they're curiously craning their neck or sitting upright, that we can kind of anthropomorphized that what their feelings might be and what they might be thinking, strikes me that part of that is that they are masters of their environment. They're the top of the food chain, and they're hunters, just as human beings are in that environment. And in some cases, the bear gets you, perhaps, you know, and that's maybe part of their, we're kind of peers in some sense.
That's part of the reason why we're so attracted to them too, because for one thing, it's one of the few animals that preys on us, and we'd like to consider ourselves the top of the food chain, and we are not. And so this is a somewhat uncomfortable reminder. I think that's part of where this fascination originates.
I was interested in looking at the book at one of the early chapters. You explore some of the images of bears that were in advertising, and not only recently, but going all the way back into the early 20th century, often kind of with a, you know, we're all familiar with the Coca-Cola ads, which are silly, but then also some of them kind of sexy, and showing bears with women and the sort of sinuous quality. And it almost seems as if the bear has been taken and used for sort of any kind of image people want to use it for. It's been a very, very flexible thing on which to project our wishes and our thoughts.
That is very true, and part of it has to do with the fact that for the longest time, the animal was not very well known to Western society, so it was easy to project whatever we wanted to project on it. And then also, I'd like to say, sort of like metaphorically, it's almost like the white non-color of the bear allows us this projection that we can make it whatever we want it to make. But underneath that, it's pretty amazing. It's been pretty amazing to me in the writing and researching the book how persistent some of these themes are across time and how they show up in different cultures. The masculinity of the bear, for example, is a theme that goes way back to, in Western society, to Norse culture, and in traditional Siberian and Native Alaskan cultures, of course, way, way before that. We have any documentation of, and it's still prevalent in this society. I mean, it goes all the way into the Hollywood 50s. The famous glamour divas shot on polar bear fur rugs, and today's use in advertising, and so on. So there's this parallel existence of various symbolisms that keeps on resurfacing throughout time. You know, themes like transformation is the symbol of transformation that the polar bear has been in traditional cultures. It starts cropping up in Western cultures in artists' poems, and then, for example, a video by the Icelandic musician Björk has a music video for a song called Hunter, where she starts going into like a trance-like state and visually is being transformed in the video into a polar bear. And that's an old theme that comes out of Iceland and also out of non-European Arctic cultures.
So this transformation between human and bear, and is that found in Alaskan myth and legend of the Inupiaq people or other Eskimo people in Alaska as well?
It's everywhere, including Alaska. I mean, it's literally worldwide. You find it all throughout Siberia and northern Scandinavia. And as you move south, it the same theme crops up. Just the polar bears being replaced by brown bears or grizzly bears. So that's it's sort of part of what anthropologists consider a northern hemisphere bear cult that shares a lot of the themes and the symbolism.
Fascinating.
In Alaska, one story, there's very close connections, and Alaskan myths express these very succinctly. There's one that comes to mind up from the Noatak River area where a woman gave birth to twins, and one of the twins was a brown bear, and one of the twins was a polar bear. And then after birth, they wandered off into the respective environments where they still can be found. So the brown bear child wandered off into the hills and the inland, and the polar bear child wandered out to sea. And basically, it's a mythical explanation of the origin of species before people had other theories like Darwin's about that. It's a way to explain the world. And to me, what this myth beautifully illustrates is also the shared responsibility that humans have for wildlife, how we're connected, and how we're basically the same offspring, related as kin. And Native peoples, there are still Native people around the world that believe that we are related to bears. And not just as a metaphor, that's actually, I mean, evolutionarily speaking, it's true. So why wouldn't it be metaphorically speaking true?
Right. So when does the polar bear enter into so the dominant Western culture, the Enlightenment infused culture, as the symbol that it became from those? Because and I guess part of my question is, when did we encounter, we, that is being a European culture, encounter the polar bear and begin to create images of it?
Like I said, the first encounters that I would consider the first European encounters that are documented are in Iceland in the Norse sagas, which, of course, in part are mythological, but in part are also just really historical chronicles of the settling of Iceland and Greenland by Norse, Norwegian and Swedish Vikings, so to speak. And so we find the first mentionings of polar bears there, and actually physically they did show up in Europe and still do occasionally on drift ice that comes over from Greenland, pack ice, ice floes that drift in the currents and then land in northwestern Iceland. And so polar bears still land there occasionally, even though they don't traditionally live on Iceland. And from there, the Vikings actually specialized after they colonized Greenland and had more access to young bears that are easily handled or easier handled than adults. There developed a flourishing trade in polar bears that Norse traders provided for medieval royalty throughout Europe and even down to Sicily, like Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, lived on Sicily, and he actually owned a polar bear for his menagerie, and he traded one further south even to a king of Egypt that then later reciprocated with a giraffe. So there was a very lively trade in exotics in those days. And from there it goes on. And then the first time Western society actually encountered polar bears on their own turf was, of course, during the Age of Exploration. The Dutch being some of the first in the 16th century going up to Novaya Zemlya in the Siberian part of the Arctic Ocean, and then later other British naturalists like Captain Cook and so on encountered polar bears more in their own environment.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking today about polar bears with Michael Engelhardt, who's author of a new book, Ice Bear, The Cultural History of an Arctic Icon. It's from University of Washington Press, and it's a beautiful book, just published, which traces the cultural meaning of the bear through a large number of images and also through the author's text, which is, as you can hear, is very erudite and full of information. So I'm sorry I interrupted you. I wanted to make sure that folks knew about your book. Well, I was interested in how the transformation took place of the image of the bear from this fearsome wild animal into sort of the cuddly and anthropomorphized animal that's in our culture today. When did that take place?
I have a feeling, I mean, there's not just one point in time or one cause where you can put your finger on, but I think part of it originated in, let's say, the late 19th century, when the polar bears were actually more and more integrated in the domestic sphere, in zoos in particular, that were open to the public, to the middle class. And but around the same time, the cult of household pets sort of started during the Industrial Revolution in England. People more and more started having pets. And I see that as a sort of replacement as people, while they were losing touch with real wild animals in their environment through urbanization and other processes, more and more integrated wild animals into their urban societies and then started treating them, you know, giving them individual names. That has not always been the case, that we've been naming individual captive animals or pets. That's just a relatively recent development. And so that is all part of the process that led to this, you know, infantilization of animals. And then, of course, animals in captivity, that's an infantilizing situation to begin with, you know, because they're not in control and they require caretaking.
So I think probably most of our listeners, although they are in Alaska, probably have only encountered a polar bear in the zoo, because most of us, frankly, never go to the Arctic. And even in the Arctic, you have to be in a certain time and place to witness a polar bear. And so, and I take it polar bears were also used in circuses. So they were not only held in zoos for us to look at in early ages of zoos. They were, you know, far from a natural environment, but also were trained to do tricks and so forth.
Yeah, but that age has come to an end. They're almost phased out now in circuses, as are a lot of other large animals. Like I just heard Bonham Ringley's just closing down the elephant show, and part of it has to do with the animal rights movement, of course. But part of the attraction that the polar bears as a circus act exerts is, again, it's human-like demeanor and appearance, and sort of oftentimes was like kind of laughed at, kind of little clumsy when we compare it to humans, maybe in the arena. And so it has sort of this clown-like effect. And the flip side of that is also acts that demonstrate the dominance over the polar bear as one of the most dangerous predators. And so it's sort of like a symbolism for the depiction of human dominance that people seem to get thrills from. I can particularly think of an incident of one of the most famous polar bear trainers of the former German East Germany, Ursula Böttcher, who was a very short 5'2 or 5'4, I can remember, a tall woman. And she had this act that she became world famous for with a polar bear, coincidentally named Alaska, who was, 10 or 11 feet standing upright. And so the kiss of death was her central act, where the polar bear would actually bend down and she would have a piece of meat in her mouth that the polar bear then would take from her, and to audiences it might have appeared like they were kissing. So there's, again, that sexual element there too, the masculinity and all these subjects that we also see in the polar bear rug shot that the Hollywood famous divas were known for. Marilyn Monroe and Rita Hayworth have all been photographed with polar bear rugs. So there's all this subject. It's never just, I found that there's hardly ever just one aspect. There's always this mixed bag of symbols, and it's kind of, can be hard to figure that out in the research, what's going on. Like the baby on the rug is another
yes
motive that was very popular for a while.
One of the images that amazed me in the book is this picture of a trainer in 1909 who has a collection of a huge collection of bears that are sort of like doing a pyramid, and I just think it's extraordinary, knowing how dangerous polar bears are, that these kinds of acts were actually done in public. And I guess the other circuses had large numbers of bears all together, right?
Well, the record holder is probably Karl Hagenbeck, who was a German circus entrepreneur and animal trader in the late 19th century, who also became revolutionary in designing new zoo environments that more realistically reflected the polar bear's native home, and also allowed people closer access without endangering audiences. But he had one act that he, I think, trained young polar bears. They had to be trained from cubs onward when they were still young and malleable. And he had this act that was put up in London and several other shows that included actually 75 trained polar bears that ended up as the highlight of the act, sliding down a giant slide into a water basin, swimming pool sized basin full of water. And the whole show was sort of like sold off as educational, wrapped in a plot like some of our IMAX movies that sort of talked about the Franklin expedition and the Northwest Passage exploration. And they even had faux effects for faux northern lights on stage. It was a major, major theatrical production.
Wow. So the symbolism of the polar bear has, it's evolved and become a symbol of climate change and of Arctic decline now. And I think that's, I picture the image from the Al Gore film Inconvenient Truth, where he has this animated picture of a polar bear floating off on a little iceberg into the Arctic. And as we heard from Andrew DeRocher, this is not an image or a symbol that is completely inappropriate, because the bear is severely threatened by loss of sea ice. But I think it's also interesting that it is almost the some of people's concern about the Arctic in a lot of the world. It seems that the polar bear might be threatened. It's fascinating that the polar bear, in some sense, stands in for the entire Arctic.
Well, it's like I said, it is just the most noticeable animal, and I call it, or other people call it, charismatic megafauna, which means they're big, and they have actually easily detectable personality, which you don't see so easily in the lemming. So that's part of the reason why the polar bear. But then also, a lot of things hinge on the polar bear. It's not, it depends on seals, and as the sea ice diminishes, polar bears won't be able to hunt seals anymore. Like the walrus spend more and more time on shore now that the sea ice diminishes, because they use that as a platform, as do the seals, to rest and to feed from. And so it's all interconnected, and the polar bear is just the topmost element, together with humans, in that chain.
Right.
So it is very appropriate, actually, but also this whole idea of a poster child, that the polar bear has been made, is sort of interesting, because if you even look at the origin of the word poster child, that used to be actual images of children with either handicaps or that were suffering from diseases that were used for public fundraising campaigns and to get people involved. And so you saw these less than perfect children on these posters. And now the interesting thing is, on the posters that use the polar bear as a symbol for climate change, you hardly ever see a hungry or starving polar bear. They're always nice, roly-poly white. And so that sort of is actually almost denying the reality of what's going on. Maybe it would be too shocking for people to see what some of these animals really look like. And there's also, of course, what the New York Times science writer Natalie Angiers calls the cute factor, that we just respond genetically from our evolutionary history to cute, infantile, beings with big eyes, and that sort of trigger our maternal instinct and our protective instincts. And so there's all, again, there are several things going on there with the polar bear as a symbol of conservation, but it's almost gotten to a point where it's been overused, where people, it does not stick out enough against the white noise of the background noise of our civilization, because you see polar bears used everywhere, not just in the environmental conservation movement. You see them on advertising, as you mentioned, Coca-Cola on Coca-Cola cans now, and of course they're all kind of trying to tie their products into the environmental conservation, promising donations to the cause and stuff. So it gets really political and gets really commercial really quickly. And
yeah,
I think it loses its power as a symbol to a degree when it's being overused.
And so you've spent quite a bit of time in the Arctic as a guide in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which sounds like is something that is a main part of your occupation. And so I'm sure you've seen polar bears. Have you seen polar bears that seem to be starving or malnourished, as you just mentioned?
I have not. The only polar bears I see on a regular basis are the ones up in Kaktovik, which is, of course, now the big hotspot for polar bear viewing tourism in North America, giving the run of its money to Churchill in Manitoba now, because it's so much more affordable and accessible. And also the experience is so much more direct and more personal. Those polar bears up there, they're not starving. They are kind of stuck on land for the summer longer and longer because the ice is gone. And so they feed on whatever scraps they can then wrangle there from the whaling carcasses that the locals leave on the beach.
Right. So in Kaktovik, there's a whaling culture, an Upiak whaling culture, and the remains, or after the butchering of the whale, the leftover organs and bones are left in a big pile, and that brings a polar bear from far and wide to feed, and then visitors are able to fly into Kaktovik by a small plane and sort of watch the bears do their behavior. And is there kind of a business there where people can do that safely and get guides and so forth?
That is definitely a booming cottage industry now in Kaktovik, where actually the number of visitation is limited now by the facilities that are able to put up visitors overnight. So there's definitely room for growth, and it is a vital income for the local community. But of course, it also causes problems, because it cannot be wild tourism. It needs to be managed. And so that's a very tricky situation. And you do get bears in town, and, you know, people up there have lived and coexisted fairly well with polar bears for thousands of years. But now that they're spending more time on land, and you get tourists into the, thrown into the mix, and it easily becomes very volatile. You know, there have been incidents of people feeding polar bears and tourists wanting to get closer and closer to get that $1 million shot and pushing the limits of what is actually tolerable. And you know, it stresses the bears. It causes the potential for accidents. And also, it gets pretty competitive quickly when there's money involved. And they're paying up to like $300 a day for polar bear viewing up there. So there's a lot of money involved.
Right. Well, that certainly happened in our part of the state with the brown bear viewing, where more and more operators are taking people out, and it starts to get kind of crowded and diminishes the experience. But I would think that Kaktovik, with as few overnight accommodations as there are, couldn't be too crowded yet, although maybe it's on that going that direction, but you would know better than I.
There are outfitters out of Fairbanks and other places, and that's part of the problem, that there's more and more outsiders trying to get a piece of the pie, whereas I and others believe that, you know, most of the proceeds should go to the people who live there, who, you know, like I said, it's hard to find year-round work in those places to begin with. But there are even outfitters that specialize on tours that just go fly up there for a day and then fly back, so they don't even stay overnight.
I see. So you've completed this amazing book, and it must have taken you many years to compile this, the pictures and the text, and to do all the research. What was your overall objective? Was it just for the first time to bring this together so we can see the whole kaleidoscope of what this animal means to our culture?
That was actually a big part of it. I really had sort of this encyclopedic vision that I really wanted to be thorough and wanted to cover most every aspect of our cultural, historical aspect of the animal. And I wanted it to be where it could stand up to academic scrutiny. I wanted to be the sourcing and everything in the research to be sound. But on the other hand, I wanted to make it a book for the general interested reader, not just for the expert. And so I have sifted. I ended up with three times as many images that actually ended up in the book, and I'm still finding new ones. I can't just walk away from this project after 4 years of research. I still learn amazing new aspects and find amazing new illustrations. But I may sound a little bit like a boast, but I don't think there can be a lot of images that I have not seen that exist of polar bears in the cultural context.
I think
if they do, and if they do, then they're illustrating themes that I've other images for that I've seen elsewhere.
Yeah. I think you've succeeded. It's a terrific book. Michael Engelhardt has been my guest. His book is Ice Bear, The Cultural History of an Arctic Icon, just recently out from University of Washington Press. Thank you for being with me today, Michael.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate the opportunity to...
My pleasure. And that's all for Outdoor Explorer today. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.